Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable, everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Today, we're going to talk about the upcoming presidential election from a litigation standpoint. Hundreds of cases have been filed across the country concerning laws and regulations relating to voting rights. And most of these cases land in the laps of state trial judges who need to wade through detailed arguments to arrive at fair decisions under really tight deadlines. So today we're going to examine some of the cases coming from one of the swing states, and that is Georgia, and also talk about the concept of judicial independence. So, Judge Gail, you ready to rock and roll?
Boy, am I. And I'm sitting here with an interesting smirk or smile on my face when we start talking about Georgia as a swing state. So that's true movement in democracy.
That is true movement. Well, Georgia has been a hotbed of litigation lately. A couple of updates before we get into the topic. In one of our last episodes, we talked about Judge McBurney of Fulton County, the Fulton County Superior Court, issuing an abortion decision, finding Georgia's abortion law unconstitutional and putting it on hold until it went to the Court of Appeals. However, after we recorded that and talked about the merits of Judge McBurney's decision and how it really challenged Justice Samuel Alito's majority opinion in the Dobbs case, the Court of Appeals above Judge McBurney put a hold on his decision. So end result is the Georgia abortion statute that Judge McBurney found to be unconstitutional is still in play. So just wanted to make that update. We'll keep you updated as that case moves along. And one other quick update, and that is October 9th, Sean Diddy Combs was back in court, in federal court in New York, and didn't get out of jail. We had an earlier episode on the whole question of pretrial release. He's still in jail, but they have set a trial date, May 5th. Now, that's moving that case along, Judge Gail. That's moving it pretty quickly because the fact he is incarcerated.
That too. And obviously, and we'll probably discuss this in another episode coming up, is the issue of speedy trial and the fact that defendants have a right to what's called a speedy trial. And the definition of that is kind of malleable, but the fact of the matter is you're right, this is a case that's going to move pretty quickly because it seems as if the defense is prepared to go forward. The prosecution is not hesitating at all, even though they say that the investigation is ongoing. They too are absolutely willing to comply with the court's trial schedule. And so this could move at like lightning speed. We'd otherwise call this a rocket docket.
this is a rocket docket. Now, if the prosecution does come up with more charges, and we emphasize that the investigation was ongoing, they may file what's called a supersedious indictment. We talked about that both in the Trump case in Washington, D.C., as well as this case. That would add more charges, and that may delay the trial a bit.
Indeed. And what could happen is the state could kind of preemptively begin packaging evidence or information that they would share in discovery, anticipating that this new indictment is going to come forward. And that could help move things along, because you're right. The process kind of starts over for the defendant, even all the way through into arraignment. So when there are new charges and a superseding indictment, that means the defendant is facing new allegations, and they have the same rights that they would if these were, you know, fresh allegations. And so the court treats it that way. They provide them notice of the new allegations, the opportunity to argue the position of bond or bail. And also, again, it as you said, could affect how fast this matter comes to trial, or whether or not the court believes and the parties believe they can stick with the original trial date, even with new charges. It can affect the date, or it could actually keep the date static. I'm actually pretty interested to see if there's going to be a superseding indictment and how the different sides are going to respond to that. But I sort of get the sense that the defendant, Mr. Combs, is not really, he's not really accustomed to the environment that he's been in. No. So he's likely going to insist, I think, on a speedier trial than others, even if perhaps his attorneys, you know, seek to argue against it so that they can gather more information or collect more information to zealously represent him. I just genuinely believe, from everything I've heard about the detention center that he's in, that, you know, he probably wants nothing more than just to be out.
Right. Well, I wanted to give those two updates, and we'll keep you posted on the Sean Combs case and do more episodes as things unfold. That's going to be a fascinating case to watch. But in the meantime,
absolutely. And I want to say thank you to our listeners. We got a lot of good responses from that episode, and we're looking forward to keeping you updated on what's happening, just so that you can understand it and you can track this case with a really good understanding of what's happening as the legal process unfolds.
So we're talking now today about Georgia, and we're talking about election. I mentioned it's been a hotbed of litigation lately, in part because Georgia, the state legislature, the state elections board, all of these groups have been passing laws and regulations really going to the election process. And in doing that, both parties, both the Republicans and Democrats, are challenging some of these voting regulations and ballot counting methods that have been put in place. And when that happens, we're talking about state law. So I want to make sure everybody understands we're talking about these cases going to state courts. The litigation takes place in front of a state trial judge. And in this case, in two cases that we're going to be talking about, that is Fulton County Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney. You remember Judge McBurney was the one who wrote the abortion decision. He's had two decisions. We're taping this on Wednesday. And on Monday and Tuesday, he has already issued two decisions this week that we thought it was important to talk about these.
And can I note, these decisions are so well reasoned, and not because I have an opinion, you know, necessarily about the reasoning and logic, but I will say I'm so impressed with Judge McBurney. I actually think he's taken more time in rendering these decisions than what we saw with Judge Cannon out of Florida.
Oh, absolutely. And the decisions are well reasoned, and one of them, interestingly enough, can't be appealed at this point. So that's going to be really interesting on the outcome it has, not on who wins the presidential election in Georgia, but how they go about processing the votes in that state. Obviously, Georgia is a critical swing state, and Judge McBurney is not alone. We want to emphasize that there are hundreds of these kinds of cases across the country. And for a trial judge to handle one of these cases that are exceedingly complicated sometimes and do it under very tight deadlines, because early voting's happening in many, many states around the country already, to do that, it takes a lot of guts and a fierce sense of judicial independence, which we'll talk about in a bit. Let's talk about the two decisions, though, Judge Gale. And the first came about where there was a law that was passed that the local board of elections could investigate and explore what they thought was fraud if they suspected any wrongdoing. They could not certify the election until they completed their investigation. Now, this could have caused untold delay. And Judge McBurney said, no, we're not going to do that. His decision was right on the money. He said, you have a mandatory duty to certify an election. It's not your job to, it's a statutory duty to certify an election. It's not your job to investigate alleged malpractice or fraud or election scams. Interesting point.
Absolutely. And here's what I think I took away from it is just a very clear-eyed decision and reasoning in saying the responsibility of this body that's been appointed is largely ministerial. Largely what we see the role of the vice president in overseeing the certification of the election in Congress. It is considered a very pedestrian, very ministerial administrative task that is largely done with little or no fanfare. And what Judge McBurney said here essentially is, hey, your obligation isn't very distinct from that. It was always designed to and intended to be this. But he also pointed out that, just as you said, Judge, that they are not an investigatory body. So they are not vested with the authority to investigate. But even if they decided to, even if they believed these misdeeds were going on, that they could, but their obligation is actually to report it to the appropriate investigatory body. So that would be prosecutors, law enforcement, sheriff's department, maybe the attorney general's office, some other body that is vested with the authority to actually investigate these matters. But even in all of that, there is nothing about the alleged discovery or preemptive discovery of this, these so-called misdeeds that should interfere with the ultimate final responsibility of this body, which is to mandatorily certify the election results by a certain time. And that, I thought, was a really, really clear decision that kind of cut the legs out, if you will, from all of the other arguments for why they should be or why there should be permission to maybe elongate this process of certification. And one other thing that he pointed out, which I thought was important, was timing. The timing of the implementation of the rules that would have called for this delay in certification was particularly delayed and late. And in an environment where there is less and less faith in the process of voting, and because there's been so much infusion of mistrust, that in his reasoning, he underscored that this no more than adds to or bolsters that idea or that supposition that something must be awry or something's wrong, and it exacerbates an issue or problem that does not need any more fuel poured on the fire. And so the timing of it was, in his view, particularly belated, in my view, flat out poor, and that the overreach of this governing body was what in the law we call ultra vires, which is outside the reach or beyond the scope or over and above what the original authority is that's vested. That is what essentially I read him saying in this opinion when he talked about it. And again, this is someone who does not have, who is making decisions without any allegiance to political party or even intonation to outcomes. It's just, hey, listen, this is the deadline. This is when you do it. These are the rules. There's no changing it. And by the way, your job is pretty administrative. And so if you find a problem, you're not even the ones to investigate it or to make a determination that it's actually a problem. You need to turn it over to the folks who do.
This lawsuit was generated by a GOP election board member who was asking the court to declare that she would have the right to delay certification. So it wasn't the Democrats challenging this. It was a Republican board member asking for what is commonly referred to as a declaratory judgment, having the judge declare that she had certain rights. And Judge McBurney just said no. He had a great quote that I'd like to get your reaction to, Judge Gale. He said, if election superintendents were, as plaintiff, the GOP election board member, as plaintiff argues, free to play investigator, prosecutor, jury, and judge, and so, because of a unilateral determination of error or fraud, refused to certify election results, Georgia voters would be silenced. Our Constitution and election code do not allow for that to happen. Now, that to me is the whole case in a nutshell, but that to me is such a strong few sentences.
Oh, absolutely. And what's more, interestingly, as he notes, if in fact this board is permitted to be the investigators, the jury, the prosecutors, the judge, the ultimate determiners, then it's also kind of paradoxical that you would actually go to the court and to the judge to say, please vest me with all this authority. Please declare right now that I have the authority to usurp you, to usurp law enforcement,
the prosecutor,
to usurp
the law enforcement,
everyone.
Everybody.
And essentially that's what the suit asked for, is for the court to essentially declare that it would abdicate or walk away from or completely divorce itself from its authority and hand it over to this board to make all of those universal decisions, which, again, I think the judge is first thinking of the rights of voters and the high propensity that those voters and the exercise of the franchise would be squashed and no longer available. But in addition to that, that essentially he might as well all but literally take his robe off and place it on the backs of those board members, because they would in fact be the ones to make these determinations. And the court, although it has the authority, would essentially be ceding it or turning it over to this board, which I thought was just an extraordinary way of articulating what the lawsuit sought to do without also trying to project or anticipate what the outcome would be. And he made no indication or no intonation of what the election outcome would be. He's very, very focused on how does these proposed rules affect the process here and now.
And let me try to really break it down even further for our audience. And that's what we try to do, is translate. He said, you have lanes. Everybody's got their lane. Your lane is to conduct the election, to tabulate the results, and to certify them to the state. If you think something's wrong, then it's the lane of the prosecution and law enforcement to investigate. It's ultimately the job of the Secretary of State to certify the results, and if that investigation brings about any problem, then the investigators and the Secretary of State deal with it. But local person, stay in your lane, count the votes, and certify it to the state. That was it. You know, don't get out of your lane.
Basically, no blinkers allowed.
You're not merging into my lane.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no such thing as a blinker. You cannot then merge, as you said, you can't merge into my lane and then decide that you're going to ride in this lane. That no, essentially every lane has, you know, cement barriers that require that you stay only in your lane. And if in fact there is something that's happened that belongs in another lane, then toss it over the barrier. But you don't get to go over and then be the one in the other lane because you decided that you could, that you are self-appointed and you do a better job
now
in that
lane. Again, we're recording this on Wednesday. That decision came out on Monday. Question remains, will it be appealed?
Is there a question?
Well, maybe. I don't know that this woman will appeal it. She liked some parts of the decision which aren't relevant to our discussion. But if they appeal, will the Court of Appeals stay, put on hold, Judge McBurney's decision, just like we talked about earlier they did in the abortion decision? Or will they say, hey, the election's underway, yeah, we're just going to go with his decision until we resolve it later for elections down the road? What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I genuinely believe that this is going to be appealed. And the reason I believe it's going to be appealed may have very little to do with the opinion itself and everything to do with the public perception. If those that are on was perceived to be the losing side of this decision, perceive that the takeaway was that they lost or that someone lost and they didn't get the decision they wanted. I think, again, given the environment and just given the nature of things, that there's kind of a mandate to keep fighting. And the way that you keep fighting here is by appealing until you get every single thing you want to land your way. And that may or may not be the ultimate outcome, but even if you're satisfied with some parts of the opinion, albeit small, I think, unfortunately, what kind of rules the day in the minds of, you know, a lot of folks that are more directly affected because they're the actual parties here, that they're going to decide, we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep fighting because we got some of what we want, but not all of what we wanted, and we're going to fight until we get every single thing we want. I don't know that that is a smart strategy, but I genuinely believe that that is certainly a strategy that is at least being contemplated.
So will the Court of Appeals put it on hold? Well, that's the question.
You know what? We've already seen what they've done with one of what we both agree is one of Judge McBurney's very well-reasoned opinions on the issue of abortion. And so I would not be surprised if they did something similar here. And what scares me and what bothers me, I think, is the idea that putting these decisions on hold and not providing the citizens with finality on these important decisions, first of all, is very dangerous.
And there's no way this is going to be resolved on the merits by the Court of Appeals before the election in the next 20 some days.
Precisely. And also to that point, I think there's also the issue of judges, at least the perception that judges are caving to political pressure, which goes to that whole issue of judicial independence, right? And whether or not there are other mechanisms at play outside the doors of the courtroom that are in any way influencing some of these decisions. Yes, even at the appellate court level, as to whether or not these decisions are stayed or whether these decisions are allowed to proceed, meaning whether there's respect for Judge McBurney's well-reasoned opinion and that it goes into effect, or if there's, you know, someone who's just hankering, if they scrawl the appeal out in crayon and just take it over there to the court to get it timestamped, betting that they'll get the outcome they want, which is a stay. And as you said, Judge, knowing that in the next 20 or so days that there's not going to be a decision on the merits of this case. Even to them, that's a win. That's good enough. And to me, that's unfortunate because that does mean that potentially the voters in the state lose out. But more than anything, they continue to lose faith in the justice system because at 20-something days before the election, I don't think anybody will argue that that's enough time to make such an important decision on the merits. And for this to even have been brought so late in the game, it just reeks of political interference. And that's the unfortunate part.
Let's go to the second Georgia case. Again, another one in front of Judge McBurney.
He's on the roll.
Fulton County Superior Court Judge. He is a busy man. This second case, the Georgia State Election Board issued a rule requiring election workers to hand count the number of ballots cast in each precinct. Now, that's statewide. Can you imagine hand counting all the votes in Fulton County or Atlanta or Cobb County, the suburbs? But that was the state election board's position. Three majority members, all aligned with former President Trump. In fact, he has lauded them.
By, I think he's name-checked
by,
them.
By
he's
name-checked name, them. he has lauded them by name for making this decision. Well, Judge McBurney blocked this requirement, saying it's too much. And as Judge Gale emphasized earlier, it's too late in the game. He said too much and too late. And there were also no instructions how to implement this crazy rule.
And no training.
And
although it doesn't seem on its face that you need to train someone how to count ballots by hand, but there is certainly a process that should certainly be implemented and trained upon in order to ensure integrity to this new process. And what you're suggesting is that now human error and the likelihood of human error is far less when compared to what we have now seen as the efficacy and the ability of machine counting. I think that's incredible. And I agree with Judge McBurney.
When you're looking at just yesterday was the first day of pre-election day voting. Early voting in Georgia. In 2020, the last presidential election, they had 135,000 people vote on that first day. Yesterday, they had 250,000 people.
I thought it was 300. So you are correct, Judge. I knew that the prior number was eclipsed. It's
been almost doubled.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how you calculate, whatever the final number, it's almost doubled. Now, can you imagine hand counting each of those?
Can you imagine hand counting just the ones from day one? You're talking about just day one.
Yeah. We're talking about the first day of early voting, you know, which will go up through election day. And then all the voting on same day, on election day, all of that be hand counted. Well, an interesting legal thing that Judge McBurney did. This was a case, a lawsuit brought this time by the Democrats, by the Cobb County election officials. Cobb County's a suburban county outside of Atlanta. The Democratic National Committee and the Georgia State Democratic Party. Those were the three plaintiffs in this case. And what Judge McBurney did was order what's called a temporary injunction. And in other states, it's called a preliminary injunction. And I want us to define these, Judge, for our listeners. There are basically an injunction is a court order ordering somebody to do something or to cease from doing something. That's what it is. And the judge can only give it if there's clear and convincing evidence that he should put things on hold until the matter is finally resolved. But there are three aspects of it. There's a temporary restraining order, there's a temporary injunction or a preliminary injunction, and then the permanent injunction. Can you break those down in common language for our listeners?
So let's start with the first one. As you indicated, we're talking about, I think you indicated the first one as the temporary injunction.
Temporary restraining order, or TROs, it's sometimes referred to.
Exactly. And so the good thing about the law is that if you look at the words really close, sometimes they can be self-explanatory. But to have a temporary restraining order, it means that the court is temporarily or for some defined period of time, usually an abbreviated or amended period of time, it is requiring that someone not do something, restraining them or keeping them from doing something, or sometimes requiring that they do something that does not cause further harm. So the goal of
let me jump in with a quick example. Don't cut down that 400-year-old oak tree.
Right. Correct.
Because once you cut it down, it's gone. So we're stopping you from cutting that down. That's an order to stop.
Right.
An order to do something is you can only have four people on the picket line. I'm ordering you to have four people on the picket line, no more.
And not more than, correct. And so you are restrained from having more than four, or you are restrained from taking down the 4th century tree or the 400-year-old tree. And often, I'd like to just say this as a side note. Often the court is imposing these orders, whether temporary or permanent, because the court is required to think about what the remedy could and should be at the outcome of the case. If certain things are allowed to happen while the case is still ongoing, or while someone's appealing a decision, or while something is happening, then it could either render the court's ultimate decision moot, meaning having no effect or impact because
means it's too late. It's too late.
It's just gone. Right. Or there could be harm that is done to a person, a party, or a thing that is not repairable, that cannot be reversed, that is so egregious, such as cutting down the 400-year-old tree, as you said, there's no getting the 400-year-old tree back. Even if you planted a tree of the same type, it's still not the same one that existed for 400 years. It is not in the same place. It does not bear the same significance. And so the harm in doing that at this juncture would be something the court could not even repair. It could not issue an order to put the tree back.
Irreparable harm, which is a term that's used.
Indeed.
Irreparable harm.
Irreparable harm, meaning, again, the harm cannot be repaired. And the court has an obligation to think about how the decisions it makes has an impact on whether or not that harm is, if there is any harm, if the harm is temporary, if the harm is permanent, if the harm cannot be repaired even by court order. And so I remember, Judge, just as an aside, I had a case where a defendant had a dangerous dog, a dangerous animal that had now been taken into the possession of the local animal control. And it was determined ultimately that the dog had attacked multiple people, that the owner had failed to take every reasonable effort to contain the dog, to train the dog, to insure the dog, to provide signage to the public warning of the dog. So all of these failings. And so ultimately, my decision was, unfortunately, that given the last incident where the dog had actually slain another dog and harmed another individual, that the dog had to be put down. Of course, ordering that a dog be euthanized is something that is irreparable because there's no way to bring the dog back once the court's order is executed. And ultimately, the defense attorney filed with the court asking that the order be stayed, or essentially to impose an injunction against myself to not order the euthanizing of the dog, because again, the harm would be irreparable. So if you think about the fact that when a court issues a decision, understanding what the impact of that is, and understanding that there's no way to remedy it, sometimes once that order is executed, is something that the court takes into effect, which is why the decisions sometimes are temporary, but they're very, very tailored. They're very specific to the situation. And if it's not temporary, if it's permanent, meaning it intends to be there forever, the court is intentionally imposing a restriction that it expects to be in place forever, then it also takes into effect or into account what they believe is, again, the harm that could be caused to or by a party.
Okay, so further translation, a temporary restraining order is short term. It's usually 14 days, sometimes 28 days, but it's short term. It's done sometimes on an emergency basis. You don't even hear, as a judge, you don't even hear both sides. You just put it on hold because the irreparable harm would be so significant. Putting the dog down, cutting down the 400-year-old tree. So you have to do something on an emergency basis, but it's short term.
Exactly. And sometimes the court will do it just until the next hearing is set. And so that's why it's short term.
So the next step is what they call in Georgia a temporary injunction, what other states call a preliminary injunction. And that is to basically take the temporary restraining order that we talked about, the emergency thing, maybe fine tune it a little bit, but put on an order keeping things in place or effectuating the judge's order while the case is pending, while the rest of the case goes on through its regular processes and ends up at trial. So what Judge McBurney did here was not decide the case ultimately. He still could, probably won't, decide that this statute of hand counting or this rule of hand counting is a good thing. But until that trial takes place, he put in place a temporary injunction keeping things on hold and eliminating the hand count while the case is pending.
Which is amazingly strategic.
It's amazingly strategic.
Yes, if you think about
it. Why is it? Because
there's no way to appeal the decision Precisely. While the matter is on hold. And meanwhile, the election process can still move forward.
You can appeal, folks out there, you can only appeal what's called a final order of the court, with some exceptions in criminal cases.
Indeed.
So here, he's saying, this is not my final order. This is my order for now, while this case is pending. And we're not going to have a trial in this case before Election Day. It's going to be well after Election Day.
Precisely.
So no final order. You can't appeal. You're stuck with my decision.
And no hand counting.
No hand counting.
No hand counting. No final order. And I'll let you know what I'm thinking about it, maybe after the fact. if there's ever an order. The other thing is, hey, listen, since there's not going to be, so back to the issue of making something moot, right? So given that there's not likely to be a trial before the election has concluded, or the election is over and there will be no hand counting, I wonder whether or not the matter will be withdrawn or determined to be moot, because the election would have concluded, the counting would have taken place, as well as the certification, and therefore there would be no reason to continue to litigate this issue of hand counting the ballot.
They're going to file some follow-up motion, I guarantee you, having him preserve all of the ballots.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can be hand counted at a later time after the trial, if they win.
If they win.
Yeah, there's going to be some action, though, to preserve the ballots so that they can say, we can still hand count.
Judge, doesn't this remind you a bit of the Jack Smith case with Judge Cannon and the motion by the defense to dismiss the charges?
Yes.
And she said, hey, yes, I'm not really going to do that right now, but maybe you should hold on to that motion and bring it up at another time.
Bring it up later. Bring it up at trial.
This kind of reminds me of something similar to that, in that
I don't know how
the court
works.
Is kind of designing strategy, if you will, that favors, seemingly, or at least on its face, it looks to favor one side or another. And maybe it's not intended. Maybe it's, just by complete happenstance that is the case. It clearly at least appeared in the Florida case that Judge Cannon was looking to join the defense team at some point or another. Exactly. I really felt like the judge was certainly traded in her robe for a nice suit to sit at the defense table. But in this instance, it seems that Judge Burney, at least again, from the reasoning of the opinions, I think he's really being thoughtful about how he takes into consideration all of these issues, because he's issuing these multi-page, very well-reasoned opinions that they aren't swinging, too far one way or another, as much as it is taking into consideration the actual role of a judge, which is to maintain the rule of law, to ensure that there's compliance with the law, and to also help to reinfuse more faith in this justice system, where obviously both parties from all political stripes are appealing to the court for the court to make these decisions. And they're relying on the court to use its wisdom to make these decisions and determinations. And here you have a judge that, and I think we've said this before, notwithstanding their, political leanings,
right,
we shouldn't be looking to judges as Republican judges or Democratic judges or independent judges. This judge truly, truly, truly appears to be just openly exercising fidelity to the rule of law and trying to help all of us to have more faith in the process. If nothing else, if I were a Georgia resident, I think that I would feel so much better as a voter, as a citizen, as a resident, knowing that this judge was on the bench, not because he's a declared Republican or because he's a declared Democrat.
I have no idea what party he is, frankly.
He really just cares about the law. And he's making very common sense arguments. When a judge says, hey, listen, this is a little too much too late, nobody's suggesting that, maybe your rules couldn't have been reasonable, but could you have done that a year and a half ago?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Could you have
trained
people?
So everybody knew what the rules of the game were. It's changing the rules after the game's being played.
It's in the fourth quarter. We're at the top of the fourth.
Yeah.
We're at the top of the fourth. And then now all of a sudden you got new rules? Really? Gosh.
So let's talk about, Judge McBurney, I think, is an exemplary example. And because Georgia's a swing state, that's why we're talking about that one state. But we've got judges all across the country, Judge Gale, that are going to have similar situations here. They're going to have similar kinds of cases. And let's hope that they have the wherewithal and the judicial independence to come up with the right decision under the law.
And you said it perfectly, the judicial independence. And so for our listeners, just basically defined, you know, remember, judges out of all three branches of government, when the framers formed the Constitution, they specifically created a branch of government on this three-legged stool, a branch of government that's not elected. Our federal judges. Our federal judges are appointed. And so judicial independence, not just for federal judges, but for state judges for whom a lot of these cases are going to end up in front of, like Judge McBurney and others, that judicial independence is really the ability and the requirement of judges to make impartial decisions unencumbered by outside pressure or influence.
And it takes courage. It takes real courage.
It does, especially in this environment. Judges are often concerned about the backlash or the response to their decisions and how that will impact their safety, the safety of their families. I mean, certainly judges—
And in most states, judges are elected in some form.
Precisely, which I think we're on the same wavelength with this, because whereas you have most judges in most states where they are elected to their position, they also understand that making these decisions might also make them political targets. Meaning, if they were going to face opposition in perhaps the next election cycle, they're almost guaranteed to face strong opposition based on a particular decision they've made. And that can often weigh on a judge's decision-making. But it was the framers who said that it was important for us in this democracy to have a branch of government that was more committed and more focused on what it means to do right by people than having power. And that is what judicial independence is designed to embody. It's this fundamental belief that power is not more important than appropriate, uninfluenced decisions, and that they should not be in the pockets of any politician. They should not be beholden to any politician. I think that's why you hear Judge Tom and I constantly, you know, kind of rebuffing this idea that you have certain politicians and former office holders who cavalierly refer to judges as their judges because they appointed them or they were responsible for beginning the appointment process, which is the antithesis of what any judge, I believe, sees themselves as, or I should say the antithesis of what most judges see themselves as, because I believe maybe there are some judges who do see themselves as aligned or beholden to some folks.
We have some examples of courage, like Judge McBurney on the abortion case, on these two cases concerning the election. You know, we've got some cases where people haven't come up, towed the line a little bit. Right in your home state.
Oh my gosh, Judge, I've got my hands up in the air. Like
Springfield, Ohio. Explain that situation.
Yeah, so in Springfield, Ohio, where a nonprofit group filed a criminal affidavit in the municipal court there.
Which is basically saying we want criminal charges to be brought against a party for wrongdoing that we think happened.
Yes, and the underpinning of this wrongdoing was the current Republican presidential nominee and former president of the United States consistently spewing and continuing to indicate falsehoods about an entire population of folks in Springfield, the Haitian community in Springfield. And that in addition to this, and I think what makes it even more abhorrent, quite frankly, is the fact that the senator from the state of Ohio, who is the vice presidential candidate and whose responsibility, whose sole responsibility, notwithstanding what they're running for, the job that they're in right now, the one they have been elected to right now, means that their responsibility is to look after their own constituents. These Haitian immigrants are their constituents. And yet the senator from the very state that is running with this vice presidential candidate also mimics and spews what has been debunked over and over again regarding these individuals who are here in this country legally, who are many of whom are working, are helping to stabilize an entire community through their work and through being there. And yet you had these individuals, the Republican candidate and his running mate, indicating that these individuals were eating pets and essentially engaged in barbaric behavior that threatened their safety and the safety of every other member in the community. And so what happened when they filed the suit in the court with the judge?
They filed the affidavit.
They filed the affidavit in the court.
A judge has to review it, but they made all their claims. This nonprofit organization made all their claims in this affidavit as to how the lies had hurt the community and hurt individuals in the community, charged what I think they wanted 3 to 5 misdemeanors. I forget exactly
and
what they
them
were.
Tied all back to the Ohio Revised Code, which is exactly what has to happen.
But
it should happen.
The judge then needs to review that to what? Decide that there's probable cause to file a complaint?
Yes, and let's define what probable cause is. It's a very simple, straightforward, two-question algorithm where essentially you ask, was a crime committed? And is this person likely the person who committed the offense? It is a low threshold. As you can imagine, it's a very, very low bar to get over. And the thoroughness of the affidavit sought to outline all of the details that supported the proposed charges under the Ohio Revised Code or under Ohio law so that those two simple questions could be answered. So what the affidavit suggested was that, yes, a crime was committed. And by identifying the offenses and the 3 or 4 misdemeanors in the Ohio Revised Code, that's the question it sought to answer.
And the affidavit was prepared by a lawyer on behalf of the Haitian immigrants in this nonprofit organization. So it wasn't just somebody scribbling something on a piece of paper.
Right. Somebody didn't just show up with, you know, some invisible ink and a couple Sharpies and a cocktail napkin from the local bar and decide to scrawl this out and drop it off at the clerk's office. This was a very well thought out exercise by not only this organization, but their legal counsel, who again identified the first question and answered the first question in the affidavit by saying, yes, crimes were committed, and here are the crimes that were committed, and let us provide you with the underlying facts of how these crimes were committed. As to the second question, as to, you know, is this person or are these people likely the ones to have committed the crime? Well, they responded to that, and was comedic, Judge, about this, is that there is so much supporting video evidence. So even if we didn't rely on statements from residents or
crime in plain sight.
Yeah, public statements by elected officials that are essentially saying, please knock it off. This isn't true. If we had an entire national debate where parts of this was repeated on national television in front of an audience of millions. And so as to the question of whether or not this is likely the person who committed the crime, this kind of answers itself. The question kind of answers itself. And yet, with presenting this to the judge in Springfield, the response was not to affirmatively agree. And mind you, folks, keep in mind, this is also very, very similar to the same exercise that prosecutors undertake when presenting something to a grand jury. And these are the same two questions that grand jurors answer. And so, and often not with as much evidence and information and direct video evidence. I mean, frequently investigations are not this thorough and complete, and they often really lack, you know, the bolstering that this one did. But notwithstanding all of this, the judge declined to issue the charges, the formal charges, against the former president and his vice presidential running mate, who's also the senator representing these same constituents. So in this instance, the judge and the vice presidential candidate represent the same constituency. And so arguably, this constituency was protected by neither, with the judge suggesting that instead this matter was transferred to the local prosecutor's office for review. And I use air quotations when I say that, for review and determination of charges, which I guess, Judge, it's fair to say both you and I know that that nothing is likely to happen with that prior to the election. That this may not be necessarily election motivated, but it certainly causes harm to a community, and that the first best chance to at least begin a process of accountability was lost by the jurist who, I, in my view, and I don't know if it was, I don't know the exact reasons, but at least on its face, it seemed to be caving to outside influences, because the evidence supporting the charges were so apparent and overwhelming that, yeah, it takes courage to say that, yeah, this was wrong and these charges are appropriate. And it also takes a little bit of self-serving to say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to find another road to kick this can down.
So not only are we talking about election cases in Georgia, but we're talking about the concept of judicial independence and judicial courage. And we've got Judge McBurney on one end of that spectrum, issuing well-reasoned decisions that have a real impact on the whole state of Georgia. And we have in Springfield, Ohio, a judge basically throwing up the hands and saying, let me kick the can down the road and have somebody else do it. And I think that's the patchwork. I think those two examples are important for our listeners, because that's the patchwork we're going to see across the country in these election cases. I don't think that Judge McBurney's decision is going to be replicated in every state and every jurisdiction across the country. We're going to have all kinds of different rulings, and this election process and the vote counting process is going to be a mess, period.
And yes, and the reason why we've not named the judge in Springfield is because in Clark County, which is where Springfield sits, there's the Clark County Municipal Court. There's more than one judge there. So without being clear on which judge made the decision, I think, again, it's important to note that there are some non-judicial considerations that affect decision-making. And when I say non-judicial, I mean that there are some things that judges take into consideration when making decisions that have absolutely nothing to do with the law and nothing to do with the case in front of them. And sometimes those considerations override everything else. You see judges that are able to ignore that and still make decisions within their purview, and decisions that are in the best interests of the community and the parties. And I think, unfortunately, you see other instances when decisions are made that, again, have absolutely no bearing on the law at all. And I would say this is a prime example of how that happened. You have Judge McBurney, who has made decisions clearly based on how he interprets the law, its impact on the citizens and residents of the jurisdiction that he's been placed in, and without any regard for how that might affect him personally or what impact it might have on him politically if someone will run against him. And then you have a judge in another community that, despite overwhelming evidence and what is obvious and clear for a very low bar to overcome, to nonetheless abdicate and to seek an opportunity to not make a decision that is important to that community. And that, to me, is that's the difference in judicial independence.
Before we scoot out of here, I've got to give you one story. When I was a very young judge, an older judge came up to me and said, "Welcome to a terminal profession." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Young judge, if you do your job with the independence and courage that you should, you'll soon piss enough people off that they'll get rid of you."
Or at least try, right? Because that certainly was my experience. I pissed enough people off in South Euclid that they even tried to get rid of the whole court. Although since I've retired, they've not said a word about getting rid of the court, which leads me to believe that either they were never serious about it or there were some other motivations at play that were either, you know, political or related to perhaps how much melanin I have. You never can tell.
Hey, we got to wrap it up. Tell people how to find us.
Oh, please. Check us out anywhere you find your favorite podcast, starting with our biggest supporter, NPR, National Public Radio. We are so excited to be partnering and affiliated with NPR, but you can also find us on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. Our hope is that you will not only listen to us, but that if you like what you're listening to, then make sure you let those platforms know. So make sure you like us, you review us, and subscribe, and come on back, because we'll keep being here and we'll continue to educate you, because as Judge Tom said at the top of the episode, we know that you don't trust what you don't understand, and our goal is to help you to understand this process more and to trust us in the process. Thank you for listening.
If you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them directly to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. If you have topics that you'd like for us to cover in the future, also shoot me an email and we'll put that topic on our list. And we have an ever-growing list that people have sent in. So please make sure that you get yours right towards the top of the list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back soon to give you more insights into the law. We want to thank you for listening. And until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks. We'll be right back.